Welcome to episode 31 of the Walk and Talk podcast. I'm Greg Johnson, and today is Monday, June 22nd, 2020. The topic for this episode is going to be privilege and the wide array of categories in life that can give us greater favor and access, or that can diminish our favor and access. Now, most recently, at this time in history, we've been hearing a lot about white privilege, and that is in the context of a national discussion about racism, both the problem of individuals who are racist and engaging in racist acts, as well as systems where nobody in the system appears to be outwardly racist, but the system itself tends to favor certain people and not favor other people simply based on their race. But in addition to white privilege, there is an entire array, a spectrum of privileges that people have based on a variety of characteristics and conditions. So that's what I wanted to talk about in this episode. And I think that identifying and acknowledging these different attributes, characteristics, sort of inherent entitlements, can help us step back and see the big picture of privilege in society and in the world today. The discussion nationally in the United States is certainly focused on regionally specific privileges. For example, if you are somebody who is visiting Thailand and you're not from Thailand and you stand out as somebody who's not from there, you may not have the same privileges as if you were in another country where you looked like you might be from there. Similarly, some countries will have discounted rates for citizens, and those who are traveling from abroad, coming as tourists, may pay a higher rate for visiting a historic site or museum or something. Now, that's not any form of bigotry necessarily. It's just trying to provide some favor for locals and boost commerce for the tourism industry. But there are just different examples of, depending on where you are and what the situation is, your level of privilege can change. Now, I know that what I'm going to share is outside the scope of the narrative. It expands the scope of the narrative, and by just adding additional information and insights may even seem to be challenging the narrative. The narrative, which predominantly is focusing on white privilege in North America and not taking into account any other kind of privilege that exists. So I think it's important to look at this spectrum, and let's go down the list then. So it would be anything that might give a person favor when you're applying for a job, when you're going to get a loan at a bank, when you are in a social situation and wanting to meet people, when you're asking for help at a store and interacting with a clerk. There are a lot of factors, some conscious and some subconscious factors, that people will notice are impacting how favored their experiences are with others. So one would be short hair. And particularly, there are many places in the United States where if you have sort of a crew cut and a short haircut, you'll be perceived to be a little more put together, a little bit more conservative, perhaps. If it gets too short, if you're kind of a skinhead, well, then that's going to look a little bit too extreme, too conservative. Then your privilege may drop out. So there's a sweet spot with your hairstyle. And if you have really long hair, in some places in the U.S., in the South maybe, that might be perceived to be that you are a hippie. Maybe you're into drugs. You might just get stopped and frisked because you look like you're on your way from or to a Grateful Dead concert or something. And so there are these preconceived notions, and police might give you a hard time. You may have a hard time when you go into stores in some places. You go to San Francisco, you go to Santa Cruz, you go to some place with a bunch of surfer people and hippies and whatever. Boy, you're going to be welcomed with open arms. You're going to have long hair privilege, and instead of, you know, somewhere else, short hair can be a privilege, can give you better favor, better access. And in some places, that issue of the hair might, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, might be up there around 8. And more so than other factors, more so even than race, you know. There are people that might be running a little coffee shop in California. You get people coming in from all over the world. It's a diverse state. Smiles, greetings, everything's just fine. And people of all different nationalities and races, ethnicities, etc., coming in the door, no problem. Then you get somebody coming in who's a long hair. Doesn't look like he might have served in Vietnam or something, you know. So there tends to be, anyway, this favor, depending on where you go, that is tied in with your hairstyle. And even for black people, if you have dreadlocks or some sort of expressive hairstyle, depending on where you go, that could either be super positively received or a point of criticism. So that's hair. And of course, the other sort of favor or privilege would be for what are today referred to as, I think, binary, or anyway, that, you know, people that are straight couples, straight people, people that are not tightly connected to the LGBT community, those people will, in most circles, have favor, depending on where you go. Again, if you go to some communities where people are actually given privilege because they're part of the LGBT community, which is, you know, that's a good thing. You don't want people to be harassed or treated poorly because of their identity and their gender and preferences and all of that. But the point is, from one city to another, from one state to another, you may have privilege because you're straight, or you may find that you have some privilege because you're part of the LGBT community. And particularly for employers that are looking to have a diverse workforce, they're going to favor some of these things. So still, on average, generally speaking, there can be some hurdles and challenges, and there's some bigotry out there. So in general, you're probably not going to be getting all kinds of favor because you're part of the LGBT community. Employers are not supposed to be biased in their hiring practices based on either what could consider to be superficial things or very deeply meaningful things, but there is supposed to not be any bias in hiring based on nationality, race, a person's religion, their orientation, etc. But even though there is supposed to be no prejudice there, inevitably people do have different types of biases and viewpoints that influence their decisions. Okay, so we have short hair on average in the United States being something that in many circles can give you privilege. And we have the gender orientation of being straight, which in general in many circles might still today give you some privilege in certain circumstances. These are in no particular order, but The next attribute on the list is your level of wealth, and maybe subtly tied into that, your affluence, which are could be two different things. There are people with money who don't have a certain presence about them, and there are people that can also have a kind of academic, educated, seeming sort of sophistication, but they're not super wealthy. But when those two things are tied together, they tend to pair well, as you might say. But anyway, somebody who is perceived to be wealthy is going to have some other assumptions being made about them, that maybe they are smart, or they work hard, or that they know the right people, or so it could be a positive thing. And generally, what happens is that people who look like they're wealthy are treated well in stores. When somebody goes to a job interview, they want to be wearing nice clothes and maybe nice jewelry and makeup, etc. It's a way to impress others. And so we might say, well, that's kind of superficial. Shouldn't we just treat everybody the same? Yes, we should. But subconsciously and consciously, people tend to give favor to those who look wealthy. And maybe it is some sense that, oh, this person could help me. Maybe they have contacts, or maybe they could be a customer, that type of thing. But wealth is an area of favor. And if somebody looks poor, even if they're not, they might not be treated well. They might be asked, please leave the store. They might be asked a number of questions. Can you afford that car? You know, at the car dealership. But poor people in general are, for no good reason probably, but stigmatized. It's assumed that maybe they're lazy or not educated, or that they might be, they're going to steal something. Maybe the assumption is they do drugs, or they're an alcoholic, or something that's caused this poverty is their fault, and some vice or something about their character has resulted in this state of poverty. So whether you're poor or rich, on a scale from 1 to 10, and it's not so much whether you are, but the perception of whether you are, is going to be a big factor. There's a saying, fake it till you make it. And the presumption behind that is that if you look successful, people will treat you differently. And then you'll become successful because people are giving you favor. So that's a little bit about wealth. And there are some companies that, well, this usually happens with multi-level marketing. There'll be a discussion, there's talking about joining this company, being part of the opportunity, etc. And quite often, salespeople want to know if you're married for a variety of reasons. One reason could be if you're looking at a car, they want to have you come in with your significant other so that they can close the deal and they know what they're dealing with. But there can be other reasons that companies may be in their hiring practices are biased toward people that they think are going to be more settled. If somebody is a homeowner, they're married, they have kids, they're going to be possibly someone who's going to be around in the community longer than someone who says, oh, I'm from this other state and I'm probably going back there in 2 years, but I want a job. And they have nothing tying them down to the community. So there can be that bias, and that's something that the law is supposed to protect against. People are not supposed to be treated differently based on their marital status, but that can be a factor. And there are some places still in the United States where hotels will not let two people share a room if they're not married. And this may not be commercial hotels, but sometimes religious organizations that have retreats, they will place that bias on people. And depending on where you go, if you're short hair, straight, white, wealthy, and married, those boxes are starting to get checked off that give you more and more favor. And if you don't check off those boxes, those are all things that can make people look at you a little different. The next category is parent. So people who are parents that are well settled down, that have jobs, kids in school, there is a certain universal kind of respect that is given to parents, and you're assumed to be somebody that really has your act together. And there is a lot of sort of admiration or maybe appreciation or respect for people that are taking on that responsibility. So being a parent can have some privilege. And as far as advertisers are concerned, you are a more valuable person to them because you have a household where buying decisions may be influenced by younger people in the family. And so your household is of more potential mining value to the advertiser and to the companies that are trying to manipulate and control your buying decisions. So the next item would be religion. And there are certain religions that seem to be more mainstream in the United States. And again, it depends on where you are in the country. But in general, if you are a Christian, let's say Methodist, Lutheran, Catholic, evangelical, perhaps not too evangelical, that can communicate that you're part of a local church and that you're well established and that you have some morals and values that fit well with you and with the church community. So there are some things that can be communicated by the fact that you are a regular churchgoer, and there can be some favor for people that have that box checked off. And for people who are maybe of some religion that people don't know that much about, that's going to raise questions just because people don't know that much about the religion. And so if it's a religion that's unfamiliar, or if it's a religion that could be stigmatized by some people in some areas of the country, if somebody is Muslim, maybe with regard to anti-Semitism, sometimes being Jewish can be perceived as a negative. So we're at a cusp right now where some people maybe have more favor if they don't identify strongly with any sort of religious organization, because there have been so many scandals and problems highlighted with organized religion that now even declaring that you're part of some mainstream Christian faith group, that can be perceived as a negative in some circles. And it really, again, depends on where you are, who you're talking to. If you're in the Bible Belt and you are not a Christian, that's going to be a problem. You're going to have trouble meeting people. You're going to have trouble making friends, getting jobs, finding a place to live. Suddenly the no vacancy signs are going to go up. But likewise, there are other places in the country, if you go there and you're some kind of, you know, right-wing, extreme, right-wing, conservative, evangelical Christian, you're not going to be welcomed with open arms. You're going to have the same sort of bias and bigotry toward you that the person who's not a religious person is going to experience in the Bible Belt or other areas where Christian faith is the dominant, predominant, and in control organization. The next category is education. So in most circles, and certainly when applying for a job, having a good education track record is important. The fact that you graduated from high school, went on to get at least a 2-year degree from a local community college or a four-year degree from a university, that definitely is an advantage in a job interview. And then if you went on to get a master's degree or a PhD, that is even more valued. Now, if you're in a community that is a university community or someplace where higher education is valued, then that education is sort of a prerequisite for having any respect in that community. There can be places in the country where people are predominantly employed in blue-collar jobs, where it probably is a mark of honor if you have a two-year degree from a community college and you know how to repair diesel engines or you know how to do spot welding. There are a number of sort of jobs and certifications and an educational background that can give you favor with others. But if you come across in one of these towns where everybody knows how to drive a semi-truck and you're talking about how you studied, you know, 15th century literature or something, and that your degree is in that, it's not going to be, you're not going to get favor. You're going to get looked down on and made fun of. And if you're, you know, maybe a smart kid in school, you're going to get bullied. You're going to be considered a nerd. Just depends on where you live and what's the tone of people toward education. Now, some of these categories that I'm talking about, when they're mixed together, can produce unexpected results. There's a very recently well-known video from a man who is talking about how he went to Harvard and he got his degree from Harvard and he practices law, but he still gets mistreated in Alabama by police. And so, you know, having a potential area of favor like a great education and going to a reputable school, that might give you some benefits, but there are other characteristics that could work against you. And so your overall score, your overall quotient, the overall favor that you have can be diminished if, you know, maybe you went to Harvard, but you have long hair, or maybe you have short hair, you're white, you went to Harvard, but you're part of the LGBT community, and now you go somewhere where people are prejudiced and bigoted against those in the LGBT community. So it just depends on where you are and what's favored in that area. So education generally is considered to be something that's going to give a person better access, better favor, better jobs, more money, more influence on average. And things that go with being successful, like perhaps, you know, having an expensive car that's like a BMW or a Porsche or Mercedes or something that people recognize, that might be assumed by people to convey that you are successful and wealthy. Now, sometimes people are leasing a car or they're driving a car that's way outside their budget or somehow trying to portray that they have money and they don't, which shouldn't even really matter. But for certain shallow people, when they see that, well, I don't want to say they're shallow, but there's this subconscious thing going on that they think, oh, that person's driving a fancy car. They must be successful. They're probably successful because they are skilled at what they do. And you'll often see realtors driving very clean, very new, very nice cars, either a Cadillac or something that is going to convey that they have their act together. And so, anyway, the car that a person drives can give them favor or not. And that certainly depends on where a person is. And if you're in Detroit and you're driving some foreign car, the car that may have given you favor in one place might not give you favor in a town that, you know, has a Ford factory or Chevy or GM, you know, manufacturing plants there. There are all kinds of factors. But in general, people, like I gave the example of realtors, will consider a nicer car to be something that's going to give them favor with a customer, let's say. There is a book about the topic of how to win friends and influence people. The intention of the book, presumably, is a good one, that people who are clumsy and awkward in social situations should know some basic guidelines about how to interact with people so that they don't commit these sort of faux pas in body language or how they talk or interact with others. It would be a shame for an otherwise, you know, smart, nice person to be looked down upon and losing jobs, etc., just because they have poor social skills. So presumably that's what that book and others like it are intended to help with. But unfortunately, there are people who really dive deep into sociology and psychology and how to kind of manipulate others based on certain techniques that will impress others, that will make other people think that you really care about them and you're listening, even if you're not. And so these books become user guides and manuals for people who don't care, for people who aren't compassionate, for people that want to manipulate and deceive others and exploit others and profit off of others and find the most efficient and effective ways to do so. And so they will do all of the things I've mentioned above to try to gain favor and privilege to the extent one can change. And they will pick their religion, not based on their faith, but based on where they think they can connect with people and hand out business cards to sell more homes, for example. Lots of the decision process then is made based on how they can have greater influence and favor. What kind of haircut to get? I don't know. Let's have a focus group. What kind of haircut is going to help me win the election? So, and it's not just politicians or realtors, and these aren't to be derogatory. I'm just giving examples of where people do try to focus on their appearance and on what their presence conveys. But yeah, so with books like this, there it becomes this arsenal of almost like advancing in different levels in martial arts, you know, where people get so skilled at being deceptive and manipulative that it's a problem. But that said, the people who have those skills, either naturally and innately because they really are listening and they really do care and they really are compassionate, or because they've read a lot of these books and they can pretend to be that way. But either way, the people with those skills are favored. And I have seen people who cannot check off. Oh, this is fascinating. I'm looking at the list right now. Everything we just mentioned. I have met and I know people who cannot check off any of those boxes. They're not white. They don't have short hair. They're not wealthy. They're not married. You know, they're not of a predominant religion like Christianity. They don't have an advanced education, fancy car, but they can walk down the street and people will treat them like they are some sort of celebrity. They'll get smiles and waves and incredible favor. So they're people that have a kind of charisma, and I would say that's an overlapping Venn diagram of, you know, people with charisma and people with these people skills, who, despite what you might imagine, everything going against them and not having the privilege and entitlements that you'd expect, they leverage that positive personality, respectfulness, cheerfulness, good listener type of people. And so anyway, that needs to be in the mix. And, you know, we've certainly heard of people who we would think obviously don't have white privilege, like President Barack Obama, didn't have white privilege, but he somehow became president. Well, he had some of these other privileges. The education component was there. The charisma component was there, etc. So, you know, where people may be encountering resistance, which he certainly did from people that don't seem to like people of color, he encountered some resistance, but, you know, he was a likable guy. He had a positive message. And so he was supported really pretty broadly by people we've learned recently, you know, supported President Barack Obama, who twice, you know, and then that later, for whatever reason, decided to support President Trump. So anyway, the point is, I think we can look at those numbers and say, wow, he was really impactful and influential and able to overcome some privilege hurdles because he had strengths in other privilege areas. And along with these other categories, and I mentioned that, you know, success, if you have the education component down, and that gets you into a good job, and that gets you to be perceived to be successful because you, you know, worked really hard at your studies and then you worked really hard at your work, you'll probably wear nicer clothing if you're interacting with the public and you know that your public image is important. There are even employers that ask people to wear business casual attire and not be wearing torn jeans and sandals, you know, just because there's some public facing situations, and also just to create a tone or a mood of professionalism in the workplace. But anyway, clothing certainly conveys something about a person. And there are wealthy people. We've heard these stories, you know, people that are wealthy, but they wear torn clothes. They drive an old car. Warren Buffett's an example. He lives in a ranch-style home. And people that don't live extravagant lives. And interestingly, despite their wealth, these other things probably hold them back a little bit. You would think that having just massive wealth would, you know, do away with these other categories, but it doesn't. So anyway, though, clothing would be one thing. And language. And this is certainly regional. If you're in the United States and you have a kind of bland, non-identifiable Midwest dialect and speak English clearly, then that's going to give you some favor in certain situations. And particularly if there are people who are bigoted against immigrants, and they don't care who it is, they just are bigoted toward anybody who seems like they're not from around here. Well, then, if you can speak in this really clear accent, English, really without, I guess, any identifiable accent, then that could be an advantage. And somebody that has a very thick accent or has difficulty with English, in some circles, with thoughtful and considerate people, they will be respected and well-treated and almost treated better than the average person. But unfortunately, there are others who would, that would trigger them. Now, this isn't globally universal, obviously. If you have a great grasp of the English language, but you're in another country, well, now you're not going to be in a position of privilege. You're going to have difficulty communicating and probably encounter some of the same, you know, bigotries elsewhere in the world that exist in the United States. But it's a mix. You know, there's going to be people who are excited to meet somebody who isn't from their area, people that want to invite you to their home and have you over for a meal. And there'll be others who, you know, don't like Americans or something. So it's a mix. But the point is, some of these things are regional. And, you know, there have been politicians who have ended up in news stories for doing this, but they will, you know, go down south And all of a sudden, that politician has a southern accent. And they start talking like they're from the south. And, you know, it's just really offensive. And people who recognize it will call them out and say, look, you're just pandering, you're pretending you're one of the locals. And sometimes, you know, a person has been from a state, let's say like Arkansas or someplace, and so they do know that accent. Maybe they had that accent when they were younger, and they can pull that back out pretty quickly, and they'll leverage that. But in general, you know, if the person's been living in New York City for 50 years, it's easily seen as a technique to try to win favor with people, but it's not genuine and sincere. So anyway, on average, and certainly the national landscape is changing so much, but on average, a person has privilege, favor, and access if they are white, have short hair, are straight as far as their gender identity, and they're wealthy, married, parents, Christians, educated, driving a fancy car, have some charisma and know the proper social etiquette. They're wearing nice clothes. They speak English very well. And you add up these things, and somebody who can check off all those boxes not only has what we refer to as white privilege, but has all of these other privileges as well. And there certainly will be areas that a person can go to where all of those things don't matter. But in general, going from one city to another, there may be scenarios where that person is treated better. I want to mention just some of the examples. There are places, let's say in Michigan, where there might be a really high number of Muslim people who speak Arabic and who are people of color. So if you go to that community and you're wearing traditional clothing and you're speaking Arabic and you're Muslim, wow, you know, you're going to have a lot of favor. You want a job? No problem. You want to get ahead in the line at the store or be treated well by clerks at the store? Not a problem. And if you go in there and you look like you are not from there, you might not be treated as well. So that is an example, and you can imagine there would be many other examples where this list I provided is not like universally 100% going to give you favor. But you could go down that list and give yourself a rating from 1 to 10 and then total everything up and kind of see what your privilege number would be. And I'm guessing that some of these things could be weighted so that, you know, one category may be more impactful in a certain area than another. But then that would be the other factor. In addition to giving yourself a number for all of these things, trying to go down the list and assign numbers for those different categories based on where you are in the moment. So the example I gave of the community in Michigan where 80% of the people are Muslim and from the Middle East, well, go down the list for that neighborhood or that city, and the favor quotient, you know, what's favorable, you can map that out. And then map up what numbers you gave yourself based on the numbers for that community. And in any of these categories, if there's something that's localized, that's favored in a certain community, you might find that one place is more favorable than another to live. Sometimes people will, you know, intentionally move to a city or neighborhood where they know that people of their identity are respected and treated well and not treated poorly. I'm interested in this topic of white privilege, but as you might have surmised from this podcast episode, in my mind, I like to think of it as something that's broader than just somebody's skin tone, and encompasses these other categories, and then that would have us engaging in a broader, more holistic, and more all-encompassing discussion about favor that allows us to acknowledge that, you know, certain people who in one circumstance might not be favored, in another do have favor. There are a few criticisms that arise of the narrative about white privilege. One of those criticisms is to show depictions of really poor white people living in shacks in Appalachia or coal miners in West Virginia, people that obviously don't have privilege, don't have money, don't have access, don't have a voice in politics. And so that's a criticism of that white privilege narrative. You take these poor white people living in trailer parks, living in poverty, no way of getting out of that, and you compare them with people of color that are, and I'm using that term to say, you know, people from Asia and every continent that come to the U.S. and get PhDs and become doctors and surgeons and lawyers and pilots and earning six-figure incomes. And that's a criticism of the white privilege narrative. It is to list and itemize or inventory all the examples of celebrities and sports celebrities and really wealthy millionaires who are from other countries or from other nationalities or other racial diversity backgrounds that are not white that have had great success and great favor. Well, that's an interesting criticism, but what we need to look at are really the averages when we look at privilege. And that's why it's helpful to take a step back and look at all of these different categories and look at the average. So on average, it still can be challenging for people who are immigrants or people of color to get access to education and jobs and opportunities. And that's because there are still some characteristics of our society that are structurally, functionally, institutionally biased based on race. And while some people manage to break through, which is great, those examples aren't proof that there's no bias. Those examples are just proof that with a lot of effort and with some luck, a person can still be successful. But it's not like everybody has equal opportunity right now. And the same is true, I didn't mention gender on the list, but women still get paid less than men for the same work. So there's an institutional bias. So we could talk about not just white privilege, but male privilege as another attribute in the list. Now, certainly if you're applying for a job at a women-owned and, you know, all-female, all-women business, being male is not going to be an advantage. But in general, in society, oftentimes, men are given favor over women. That's changing, and there are laws to prevent that. There are laws to ensure that everybody has equal access based on the merits. But again, whether it's gender, race, nationality, whatever, there are these biases. And another example of a criticism that comes up I recently encountered this was Denzel Washington was having a discussion about, you know, is the system biased and can we blame the system? Is there institutional racism? And he was saying no. He said that the reason he was successful in life was because his father was around and his best friends when he was growing up all ended up going to prison and serving long terms for different crimes. They didn't have a father around. And he said that it's not that we have a racist system necessarily. It's that, you know, these problems start in the home. He was saying, where were their parents? Where were their dads? That's why the problems happen. So that's one of the arguments that gets used as a criticism of the white privilege narrative. Well, again, the problem with that, number one, is, you know, speaking as a well-regarded, well-informed, very respected, successful black leader and entertainer, I mean, he's going to be listened to, and what he says is going to be taken seriously. But I have to say that, you know, he's an example of an exception. Not anybody that wants to just snap their fingers and get on a bus and go to Hollywood is going to become the next Denzel Washington. There's some luck in there. There's some probably, you know, inherent skills and abilities that a person has to be a successful actor that aren't just universally given out to everybody when they're born. You know, some people become Olympic gold winners, but that's partly a lot of effort and support from family, but some talent that people are born with as well. Morgan Freeman is another person who has criticized the narrative of white privilege and was asked in an interview if he thought race was a factor in limiting people's success today. And he said today, no, implying that yes, in the past it had been, but today it's not. And in this interview with a CNN reporter, he said, look at us. And the reporter was black. And he said, look at us, we're successful. And we are proof that really anybody can do anything and that race isn't a factor. Well, that's a wonderful sentiment. And it's certainly true that, you know, inherently people are not necessarily limited. There are certain areas we can excel in if we have gifts in certain areas and abilities. But in general, no, we're not different from one another significantly that would cause there to be any kind of limitations. And so you do want to preach a message that, you know, follow your dreams, follow your heart, reach for the stars, you can do it. But the reality is that just in general, there are limitations. Not everybody that wants to grow up and be an astronaut is going to be an astronaut. There's a limited number of people that are going to become an astronaut. So there's that. And then there's also the fact that Morgan Freeman, like Denzel Washington, no doubt has worked hard, has some great skills, but had some luck along the way. And his experience and that of other people like him are not exemplary or examples of what 100% of the people can expect is going to be their outcome. And so it depends, again, on the community you're in, what career you're in, who your connections are, and that as long as there are some layers of institutional bias, there are people that are going to get held back in one way or another. Could be something as simple as, you know, you move to LA and you start going to tryouts for different, you know, TV shows or movies or even just getting advertising gigs. And all you want to do is, you know, get a job at a restaurant in Brentwood or someplace. And maybe that's not so easy if you don't look like you're from around there. And some of it can just be favoritism. You know, that example of there are a limited number of jobs in the area, and those jobs are going to go to people that are from that area. So-and-so's kid, or, you know, a favor gets called in and somebody gets a job, not because they had the best qualifications, but just because they knew somebody. So there can be that as well. So even though there are these wonderful success stories, we need to step back and realize, okay, those success stories definitely prove that the sky's the limit and anything's possible and there's no more glass ceiling necessarily, but people still try harder than somebody else. Women get paid less. That means if a woman's getting paid 70 cents on the dollar, she's going to have a full-time job plus another part-time job just to make the same amount of money. And that's not right. And probably the same is true on average for people in all of these other categories where there might be bias. If somebody's part of the LGBT community, they may have a hard time finding a job or may not get paid as well. So all those people who are struggling to go upstream against the water, there's this extra measure of resistance at every encounter, at the store, at the job interview, at the car dealership, wherever they go. They're going to find some bias, some bigotry that just makes life overall cumulatively more difficult. And so the problem with that also is that there's not like one place or one business or one person you can necessarily point to and say, oh, that's the problem right there. Or if we would just change this one person's mind, then everything would be fixed. That it's a whole system, it's a whole society, it's a whole history, it's multifaceted, and there are all these other factors as well. But in general, raising awareness, trying to create more opportunities and equal access for everybody, trying to create legislation that ensures there will be some repercussions to bias and bigotry in the workplace, then, you know, as that happens, we can change the landscape and make opportunities and jobs and education more accessible equally to everybody. Appearance is another factor that can influence the amount of favor we have and the amount of privilege we have. So you would normally need to combine attractiveness with some other category of benefit. So someone who's attractive but does not have good skills or good communication and social graces, someone who's attractive but doesn't have these other benefits, they won't be as influential as they could be if they combined attractiveness with an advanced degree or an exceptional skill like singing or acting. So attractiveness is a powerful influencer, but it's not completely a game changer on its own. And yet we have seen in anecdotes and in movies, and probably you've experienced this in your own life, how attractive people get a lot of attention. They get attention, whether it's in Hollywood, getting selected for gigs, or whether it's just, you know, in school or in a store or whatever. Attractive men, attractive women tend to have more favor and more influence in their interactions. And a lot of these things are indeed seem to be superficial. And we would almost, well, those of us who aren't super attractive or super wealthy or super connected, would say it's unfair. And, you know, why does society give favor to people who have these different attributes? That seems wrong. It seems unfair. And there are efforts to change that, to level the playing field. But until the playing field is completely leveled, these other factors are going to be influencing the amount of privilege and access and favor that people have. Well, we're at the end of this episode. I appreciate you taking time to listen, and I hope you found these ideas thought-provoking. I appreciate everybody who subscribes and clicks like wherever that's available, and I look forward to sharing more with you again soon. Take care.